Welcome to the RSA Events Podcast, the home of world-changing ideas and debate.
Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Rebecca Ford, manager of the RSA Student Design Awards programme, which challenges emerging designers at university level to respond to complex social issues. And I'm delighted to welcome you all here today for this special RSA Thursday event. Before we begin, could I please ask you to turn your mobile phones to silent? And we're filming today and live streaming over the web, so a very big welcome to those joining us online. This event is part of the fabulous Global Festival of Genius, hosted by our friends at 92nd Street Y in New York. So a big hello to everyone tuning in around the world too. The hashtag for the event is hashtag RSA Culture, so please do also join the discussion on Twitter. Now, I'm absolutely delighted to welcome today's speaker, Daniel Coyle. As you may know, Daniel is a New York Times best-selling author of The Talent Code, winner of the 2012 William Hill Sportsbook Prize of the Year, He is a contributing editor for Outside magazine and works as a special advisor to the Cleveland Indians baseball team. His latest book, The Culture Code, demystifies the perceived magic of highly successful groups and has garnered praise from many quarters. I particularly loved the mix of vivid storytelling, compelling evidence, and practical guidance in the book, and the huge breadth of insights that are drawn from very different yet analogous contexts. Please join me in giving a big, warm welcome to Daniel Coyle.
Thank you so much, Rebecca. It's wonderful to be here with the RSA and with you. I'd like to start by asking you to do something for me. Take a second and think about the most connected team that you've ever been on. The most cohesive team. It could be a team from school, it could be a team from sports, it could be a group, it could be a family group, it could be work. But think about that feeling, not your performance, think about that feeling, what that feeling feels like to be on a team that is cooperative, cohesive, and connected. Have you got it? So here's a question. What's that worth? What is that worth? How does that add to performance? How much would that add to performance? We know that good groups are more than the sum of their parts. How much more? I'm asking you because there was a Harvard team that researched this. They looked at 10 groups that were the same except for culture. One had a strong culture and one had a weak culture. And the difference in performance was 756% over 10 years. Net revenue, they were businesses, net revenue over 10 years, which nicely frames why we're here. Because culture is performance. Because culture makes groups add up to more than the sum of their parts. Whether that culture is our community, whether that culture is our family, whether that culture is our work or our sports teams. It adds up to something. And the question really is, what's this space made of? The space between average and 756. If we could see it, if we could feel it, if we could know when we're moving up and moving down, what would that be? So today, I'd like to spend some time thinking about a new mental model for this space, a new way of thinking about this space, and for giving you a few tools that you can use to navigate this space, maybe even tomorrow. And it starts exploring this space with a story, and that story is about me. I'm 10 years old, and I'm focused on a really simple question, actually obsessed with a question. How do I get really, 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 really good at baseball, good enough to play for, I had thoughtfully narrowed it down to two teams. The St. Louis Cardinals, because they won all the time, and the Cleveland Indians, because they never won. They never won. They had never won a World Series since 1948. I loved those teams, and I wanted to be a part of it. However, I ran into a little problem. The first problem is that I was growing up in Alaska. That's June, if you can see the snow. That's June. Second problem, I kept striking out when I got to the high school age. I couldn't play that well, and so I made a decision. If I couldn't be a great performer, I would study great performers. I grew up to be a journalist and a researcher. And my job essentially is to travel the world and look at great performers and see what makes them tick. Look at the science of great performance. I married a girl from Ohio and moved to Cleveland about 10 years ago. And one day, my telephone rang. And it was the Cleveland Indians. They finally called. And they were in a bad spot. They had been had one of the worst records in baseball the last 5 years, the previous 5 years, and they were looking to bring in new ideas. And they had read some of my work, and they said, we want to bring you in. And one thing led to another, and I took a position as an advisor to the Cleveland Indians. And then something even more surprising happened. Cleveland started winning. And winning, and winning, and winning, and winning. For the last 5 years, we have the best record in the American League. We have spent $400 million less than our rivals. We're a small market team that is adding up to more than the sum of our parts. Last year, we broke a 100-year-old record for consecutive wins. So being on the front lines and watching that rocket ship take off, watching that transformation, sent me on a journey to go around the world and look at great groups, high-performing groups, groups like Pixar, groups like Navy SEAL Team 6, groups like IDEO, and seeing what they have in common. And go into that question of how. What is that space made of? How do we get better at that? How do we add up to more than the sum of our parts for the common good? There's a story that we've told about this space, a traditional way to think about this space, about culture. And it goes like this. Culture is the soft stuff. It's the soft stuff. It's complex. It's nuanced. It's something people have. It's a quality that groups have. It's sort of entwined with their DNA. That's how we think of it, as a quality. And if we were to represent that traditional way of thinking about culture on screen, it would look a little bit like this. What is culture? How do we get better at culture? Well, you want to have values, right? You want to have leadership. You want to have trust. You want to have teamwork and integrity and mission and purpose and honesty and integrity and cohesion. And the list goes on and on. This is a perfectly true list. All this is, in fact, true. But it's useless as a tool. It's not a good tool. How do we get better at culture? Well, do this stuff. Right? So it's a huge irony. Culture is by far the most important thing you do. Culture is by far the most important force in our community, in our families, in our organizations. And our way of thinking about it is medieval. Is medieval. So I want to give you a new way of thinking about this space, and it starts with a group that maybe you've already known. Maybe you've already met this group. Does anybody know what these are? Starlings. Right. Beautiful, right? These are starlings, but this actually captures what it's like to watch a Navy SEAL team on a mission. This is actually embodies what it's like to watch Pixar make a movie. This embodies what good groups do. They move at speed. Information flowing through the entire group, solving problems in real time. That's what great groups do. And the funny thing is, starlings have brains as big as a grain of rice. They're not paying attention to values or mission or purpose. What they are doing instead is doing the thing that all good groups do. They're paying keen attention to signals of connection. They're paying keen attention to signals that share information with each other. They're sharing accurate information and signals of direction. And here's the thing. You are not so different. There's a deep human grammar of connection that we all are connected to. Signals. It's a language. It's a language not of words, but of signals. Signals that connect us, signals through which we share information, and signals through which we determine direction. And it looks like this. This is the model for thinking about this space of culture. How do human beings connect? Well, we connect through safety. We build safety. When we get a signal of safety, we connect. How do we share information? How do we share accurate information in groups? We share vulnerability. We open up to each other and tell each other the truth. How do we determine direction? How do humans determine what direction their group should go, whether that group is a family, a sports team, an organization, or a community? It's a story. That story tells us what direction to go. This is a functional map of how culture works. It's a grammar of signals that we share. And I want to walk through, sort of in a primer way, to speaking this language to you today. Learning how to speak connection, learning how to speak vulnerability, and learning how to speak story. There's a moment in group life where connection either happens or it doesn't. You're in a group, everyone's excited about a project, and people buy in. We call that buy-in, because people are literally investing in the group. Feeling connected. And we know what that feeling feels like. It's a wonderful feeling. Sometimes it happens in a fake way. People seem bought in, but then push comes to shove, and they're not quite bought in. They're not quite there. It's a really mysterious moment in group life. What makes people feel that connection in their guts? That feeling that you felt when we first reflected on it in this session. There's a man named Peter Skillman, who's an engineer, who dug into this question. And the way he decided to explore that question was through a contest. Simple contest. It was who could build the tallest tower with the following materials. 20 pieces of raw spaghetti, a yard of tape, and a single standard-sized marshmallow. Only rule, marshmallow goes on top. He had teams of four, teams of CEOs, teams of lawyers, teams of MBAs, and teams of kindergartners. I'm not sure why I went here for kindergartners. Kindergartners, right? Ready, set, go. And all the adult groups start the same way. They circle up and they begin to talk. They talk. They make a plan. And then they improve on that plan. They have more talking. They improve on that plan. Then they divide up in roles. And then they start to build. And it looks gorgeous. It looks smooth. It looks cooperative. It looks like the embodiment of perfect human cooperation. The kindergartners, not so much. They basically start eating a lot of marshmallows. And then they haphazardly start jamming stuff together and taping, and it looks like complete chaos. And if you had to bet your life savings, which group would win? If you had to put your life savings in a suitcase and carry it over to the group you thought would win, most of us would pick an adult group. No question. Because that's the way our mental model of group performance works. Our mental model focuses on what we can see. And what we see when we see intelligent, cooperative, experienced individuals working together, we assume they will combine into an intelligent group. When we see chaotic children jamming things together, we assume it is going to be a chaotic group. So let's see how our bet turns out. There's tower height in inches. There are the MBAs. Nobody was going to bet on them anyway. There are the lawyers. They do a bit better. There are the CEOs. Do a bit better. But nobody touches the kindergartners. They win every time, and it's not even close. And it seems like an optical illusion. It seems like an optical illusion. How does that happen? And it's because our mental model does not take into account the two most important factors of group performance, status management and safety. The adults look like they're cooperating. In fact, they are managing status with each other. While they're talking, there's a whisper in the back of their heads. Who's in charge here? Where do I fit in? Is it okay to say that? Nobody wants to be CEO of Spaghetti Incorporated. The kindergartners work together, and because they work faster and because they don't care and they're not worried about who is in charge, they're able to iterate, ideate, and innovate more rapidly. What gives you better feedback than your tower falling down? Perfect feedback. How to fix it? Let's fix it together. Safety is not just some atmospheric feeling. It is the core of good group performance. It is by far the most important factor. It makes you smarter, that moment of connection. I want to tell you about a great experiment that was done by a company called Wipro. We normally think belonging sort of happens. It's chemistry, right? It's just chemistry. And Wipro was a call center, and they were having trouble with creating a sense of connection in their people. They were having trouble because working at a call center is a pain. It's really hard to work at a call center and answer calls all day. Every year, 50% of their people would leave. Their retention was terrible. So they tried to fix it. They improved the facilities. They improved the HR function. Nothing worked until, in desperation, they tried a one-hour experiment, and they divided the group into two. One group got a presentation for 1 hour about Wipro. They met a star performer, and they learned all about the history of Wipro. They got a tour of Wipro, and they got a shirt with Wipro's name on it. For the second group, they flipped it. Instead of talking about Wipro, they asked questions about the trainees. They asked, tell me what happens on your best day. What happens on your worst day? If we were on a desert island marooned, what skills would you bring to our survival? And they had a conversation about that. And then they all got a sweatshirt with their name on it, not with Wipro, with the trainee's name. Then, spin the clock forward 7 months, retention in this group goes up 270%. Not 7%, not 70%, 270%. Why? Because they received a crystal clear belonging cue. They created safety. Safety doesn't descend from the heavens by magic. It is created in clear moments where you deliver a signal, I see you. We are connected. We share a future. So let's dig into the next word, which is really all about openness. When I was traveling around visiting Pixar and Navy SEAL Team 6, I kept having the same interaction where a leader would open up to me. I was walking around Pixar and walking through a beautiful building, and it was the most beautiful building I had ever seen. And I'm from Alaska, so I haven't seen many beautiful buildings. But it was incredible. And I said to the president of Pixar, Ed, this is the coolest building I have ever been in. And he said, actually, this building was a huge mistake. Like a $20 million building. This building was a huge mistake. We made the hallways too narrow. We put the atrium in the wrong spot. And what's more, we made all those mistakes and didn't even realize we were making them. Stunning openness. I met a Navy SEAL commander who said, the most important four words any leader can say are, I screwed that up. Interesting. I thought SEALs were confident. But I kept getting those signals. So I'd like to explore that a little bit with you. Are you up for doing an experiment? Okay. We're going to divide the room into two. You're about to see three questions. Pair with the person next to you. Okay? Pair with the person next to you. And you each get to pick a question from one of the columns. This group, here's our dividing line. This is group B. This is group A. So you'll pick a question from column A. You each will ask that question to the other, and you'll answer it. So you'll each get a turn of asking and answer. You only have 2 minutes. Okay? So here you go. Here's A's questions. Pick one of those three questions. Pick someone next to you. Ask and answer it. Here's B's. Pick someone next to you. Ask and answer that question. Ready? Go. One more minute. You have 1 more minute. 1 more minute. All right, 10 seconds. 10 more seconds. All right, well done, well done. Should I crack a whip? Well done, that's good. Wind it up, please. You guys are really, yeah. Well, that certainly set things off. All right, thank you, thank you. Well done, well done, well done. Thank you, well done, well done. All right, I can tell you one thing I can confirm. I can confirm that the R does not stand for reserved. You could keep going all day. I was going to quietly slip out, if that's okay. If that's okay. So, interesting, to observe that from afar. Group A started up instantly. It was very quick. The body just turned and they started right away. This group, there was sort of this, but then when it got going, it really got going. If we were to measure the kind of energy level and the expression and the gestures, this group sort of kept on ascending. So, what's the difference between those two columns? Just shout it out. What do you think the difference is? Yeah, yeah. Column A is some facts that you can deliver. Column B digs a little bit deeper. There's something there. There's layers. There's a little disclosure there. There's a moment. There's a moment. And it's a moment called vulnerability, where you have to disclose. The root word of vulnerability is vuln, which means wound. It's a little painful to sort of dig into that. For example, if someone had asked me, describe the last pet you owned, I got that. I got that. I can crush that question. That's an easy one, right? I got it. Cockapoo, 15 pounds. Name was Moby. Okay? How about this? Is there something you've always dreamed of doing? Why haven't you done it? Screw that. I'm good. I'm going to stick with the pets. It requires a moment. It requires a moment of vulnerability and openness. What that's called is a vulnerability loop. It's a loop because two people have to do it. If one of you does it and the other doesn't, it doesn't count. What's interesting is when you create a vulnerability loop and then test cooperation and performance, if we were to give you a test that measured your relative ability to cooperate, like a puzzle you had to solve with your partner, this group would score higher, about 24% higher, which is bizarre because normally we think our model of trust is, I need to trust you before I'm vulnerable. But we're wrong. We have it exactly backwards. When you are vulnerable, it creates trust. When you are vulnerable, when you open up and have a vulnerability loop and share weakness and share truth, it creates closeness and cooperation. And the places that I visited operationalized that. They didn't just leave it to free range openness. That's what that president of Pixar was doing. He was sending a signal of openness. That's why the Navy SEAL commander says, I screwed that up, are the four most important words a leader can say, because they free up a conversation about what actually happened. Truth, accurate information. And good groups operationalize this like a habit. The SEALs have something called an AAR, which is an after-action review. After a mission, they circle up, they talk about what went wrong, what went right, and what they'll do differently next time. It's a hard meeting. It's a hard meeting to have, but it's incredibly powerful because it allows information to flow in the group for the common good. So that moment of sharing weakness is what makes groups strong. But let's move on to something bigger. Where's a group headed? What's the story? I want to tell you a story about any group can survive when things are calm, but there are some moments that define a group when a crisis happens. And there's never been a crisis like the 1982 Tylenol poisonings. Do you remember that? Yeah. A madman put arsenic in random bottles of Tylenol, extra strength Tylenol, and put them in the drugstore in Chicago, and people took them unknowingly and died. So Johnson & Johnson, the maker of Tylenol, gets a phone call one day, says your product is being used as a murder weapon. What happened next was remarkable and remains the gold standard of crisis response. Tylenol on its own invented tamper-proof packaging in a matter of months. They voluntarily pulled $100 million worth of product against the advice of the FBI. The FBI thought it would cause a panic. Tylenol pulled it anyway. They dealt with unparalleled openness with the legal community and the public about this. They responded like that group of starlings. They all knew where to go at the same time. Question is how? How did they do that? Well, when you play the tape back, the previous 4 years, there was an executive at Tylenol who created an intensive whole company conversation around a simple question: what comes first? What comes first? Does our shareholder come first? Does our stock price come first? Do the doctors come first? And what they decided and what they literally carved in granite, our users of our product come first. By creating that conversation and that awareness, he created a purpose for that group. And when the crisis happened, they knew where true north lay. They knew what to do. What was fascinating about visiting these places is whenever I would go into one of these groups, it always felt a bit corny. They always were repeating these sort of mantras over and over again. These things, like when you're in the Navy SEALs, they talk about, what do? We shoot, move, and communicate. The only easy day was yesterday. That's another mantra. Another mantra they have is, we're the quiet professionals. They talk all the time about how they're the quiet professionals. They talk about it over and over and over again. And you see that in a group, and I began to see it actually as a sign of a smart group. Purpose doesn't come from within. It doesn't come from the heart. It comes from the windshield. It comes from leaders who fill the windshield of their group with a map of mantras that allow the people in that group to navigate to solutions. There's a restaurant that sums this up, Danny Meyer's. Anybody ever eaten at Gramercy Tavern or the Union Square Cafe? They are the Pixar of restaurants, incredible restaurants, and they have amazing success. Danny had one successful restaurant, and then he opened another, and the culture started to slip, because he was what great looked like. When he was in the restaurant, everyone could look at him and say, that's who we should be. That's our culture. But when he was gone half the time, no one remembered that. So Danny Meyer closed both restaurants and went on a retreat and started writing this. This is sort of their mantra map. What is true north for us? Creating raves. That's our job, above all else, creating raves. How do we do that? And notice, these things are all a little bit cheesy, aren't they? We read the guest. We find the yes. My favorite is, mistakes are waves. Servers are surfers. Right? A bit cheesy. You feel like you're at summer camp. That actually seems like a weakness. It's a strength. Because he's realizing, it's not about inspiration. It's about navigation. It's about navigation. And there was a moment recently, I was having breakfast with Danny Meyer, and someone tipped over a tray of glasses. They fell to the floor and crashed. And Meyer stops, and he looks. And I said, "What are you looking for?" He said, "One of two things is about to happen. Either they're going to come together and solve this problem, and the energy level is going to go up in this room, or there's going to be a hint of anger and resentment, and the energy level is going to go down." Fascinating. And that's when this started to make sense to me. Loving problems. Athletic hospitality. The excellence reflex. Smart leaders build these. What's your version of that? So we end up with that sort of the language that we're talking about. But how do we bring that home? I want to give you three quick ways to sort of bring that home. Three quick ways. One is use the open face. I saw this over and over again. I would travel around to all these different groups, and all the people had the same expression, which was this. This zygomatic arch is way up, way up. A symbol and an indicator and a signal of intense interest and curiosity about the person. That face. There was a Navy SEAL commander who says, "Your face is always, it's either closed or it's open. Open it." Secondly, to do an AAR. All of us live in groups. All of us do projects. We finish a project, we walk away. There's a moment there. If you take time to circle up, if you take time to say, "What just happened? What went well? What didn't go well?" It's incredibly powerful. Thirdly, to send the two-line email. This is from Laszlo Bock, who did people analytics at Google. Send an email to people you work with, and it just has two lines. It says, "Tell me one thing you want me to keep doing, and one thing you want me to stop doing." That's it. It's a pretty easy email to send, actually, but it sends a very powerful signal. I want to learn from you. I'm not above you. We're all learning together. I'll throw in a bonus one, actually, that I started to use at home. I spent time in all these cultures and started, and you know that conversation you have with your children where you say, "How was your day?" How does that conversation usually go? Is that usually a good one? In my house, it's not a good one. "How was your day?" "Fine." Okay. Hard to do that. But if you instead lead with your failure, if you lead with something you goofed up at, I just had a speech and I called the guy who organized it was named John Gordon. I called him Peter, like all day. It was really, really classy on my part, and I'm going to bring that to my dinner table, and I have a feeling it's going to be a good conversation. So thank you very much for having me. I appreciate the opportunity.
Thank you, Daniel. I'm going to jump straight in and ask you a few questions myself before opening up to the audience for their questions. So, as well as observing lots of different teams, you've been a part of a number of fascinating teams yourself. You mentioned your role in the Cleveland Indians baseball team. So what's your best and worst personal experiences of group culture? And perhaps you could tell us a little bit also about how much you have adapted your behavior and the signals that you use through writing this book.
Sounds like you're trying to make me be vulnerable, Rebecca. I have to say, I want to tell you about my dog.
Okay.
It's funny, I went on searching for the worst culture. That was part of this process. I went to search for it, and terrifyingly, it happens to belong to the people who are in charge of the Minuteman missiles in North Dakota and Montana, the American arsenal. It is the worst culture. It is, they fail in proficiency, there's drug scandals, there's cheating scandals, and when you look at why that is, they're officers in the bottom of a hole, literally isolated from each other. There's no career advancement out of it. There's no larger reason why they do it, because the threat is largely gone. And when they make a mistake, they're punished severely. They'll lose their position. So it's this perfect, unsafe environment that creates this horrible culture. And it was sort of interesting how much it was a funhouse mirror of the great cultures that I saw. The best culture I've been a part of actually is the Cleveland Indians. They're incredible. And the signature thing, there is, they are incredibly caring to me and my family, but when someone leaves, the way they treat someone who leaves is unbelievable. They will prepare them for, if they have a job opportunity, they'll spend hours preparing them for that interview, that exit interview, for their leaving. So that care, which is manifested in the way that people leave, ends up being the most memorable bit to me.
Okay.
Yeah.
Right, now I'd like to talk a little bit about pivotal moments. Mm. So for me, one of the most powerful insights in the book was the fact that it's often in these pivotal crisis moments that successful cultures are formed or reformed or strengthened. You know, yes. You mentioned the Johnson & Johnson Tylenol incident there. Yes. And it's International Women's Day yes. today. Yes. And it feels like we are at this yep. really pivotal moment right now in terms of women's empowerment and addressing the power imbalances that exist in the world in so many groups and organisations and you know across different sectors, across different parts of the world. So I'd just like to invite your thoughts now on the role that power and gender balance play in creating successful groups.
Right, that's a great question, and it's nice to be here on this great day. You know, every group has got either a healthy or unhealthy relationship with power, and what we've seen over the last few weeks and months is this crisis, which is creating, the wonderful thing about crisis is that it creates clarity. A lot of the groups, when you dig into successful groups, most of them have had a moment of crisis. Most of them, and that crisis ends up being a great force for clarity and good, and it's the moment when the mechanisms that actually build the culture. Cultural mechanism is sort of like physical training, physical workout. If you're going to be a healthy person, you know that you need to have these mechanisms you do every day, these habits. Mm-hmm. And those habits get formed in moments like this. You can trace, right, Pixar and the SEALs both had these terrible crises that really caused them to question their very reason for being. And out of that was born the modern Pixar. And actually, the leaders of those places today are wistful for a crisis. It's so hard. They speak nostalgically about these moments of incredible urgency and terror. And they long for them. So this I think bespeaks, it's easy to get caught up in the painful elements of this moment and the difficulty of this moment, but there is a deep opportunity here to kind of reform the norms of how we interact and how power is distributed in all organizations. And it's an amazing opportunity that can lead to great growth.
Okay. So I'd like to talk now a little bit about how you identify these incredible organizations where there is a really positive culture. There's increasing competition for talent these days, yep. and a lot of the graduates that I meet are, well, they're either looking to set up their own thing or are really seeking this kind of purposeful, inclusive, and empowering sorts of organizations that you describe in the book. So what advice do you have to help people, whatever stage they're at in their career, right. to really discern right. how cohesive right. an organizational culture is before they, jump in there? Right. So if I was going to a job interview tomorrow, right. let's say, right. what questions could I ask? Or what other things might I do to really get beneath the skin of an organizational
culture?
What a
cool question. What a cool paragraph. I would say three things. First of all, do that litmus test that Danny Meyer did. When they wait for a moment when the glasses drop, see how they respond to a problem. Does the energy level go up or down? Secondly, ask this question. Tell me a story about your group that wouldn't happen anywhere else. Tell me a story that defines your group. What is something that wouldn't happen to any other group in the world? And third, ask this question. What gets rewarded around here? Try to figure that out. What gets really rewarded around here? And I guess the fourth thing I would add is, talk to people who have left recently. And if they are hesitant to introduce you to those people, that's your first sign.
Yeah, okay. Great advice there. So the RSA is a historic organization. We're over 260 years old, and we're also a stone's throw here from a lot of other historic and very big public sector organizations that are based down the road in Whitehall. How much do you think the size and maturity of organizations impacts their ability to develop and replicate successful groups?
It's massive. A culture really comes down to sort of, often it's the few feet around us every day. Culture is the 15 feet around me every day. And when groups scale, and I saw this vividly at Google, Google early days, incredible, incredible teamwork. The founders would play roller hockey on their breaks. Everybody could bang into them, talk about vulnerability and real giving feedback, and they were very nimble. And I was just at Google recently, and it's a massive place, and they have some real cultural struggles. They have 64,000 people that work there now. It is really difficult to scale. The killer app of culture is face-to-face interaction. And so finding ways to do that is a huge challenge. And you can kind of liken it to sort of domains in music. You've got kind of the small coffee house, and then you've got huge stadium rock. And it's a different genre. It's a different set of challenges. But you always want to return to that 15 feet around you, those daily interactions. That's where culture really happens. And tuning into those moments of connection or lack of connection, of openness or lack of openness, or of direction or lack of direction, is a powerful first step.
Okay, you note in your final chapter, which is on purpose, and that's something you also mentioned in your talk, that groups need to really evolve and respond constantly to an ever-changing world. The RSA actually has a future work centre that is looking at some of the big challenges that we're facing in relation to work today. And what, in your opinion, are the key external forces that groups are really having to navigate and respond to in the world today?
Speed is one, speed. The whole world is turning into essentially a learning contest, whether that's business, whether that's charity, whether that's sport, whether that's art, the speed of that. And it's easy to get lost. There's a tension with speed where you begin to just sort of chase speed for its own sake. But actually, you need to look deeper and realize what you're really about is learning and growth. And so providing spaces for people to learn and grow in your organization isn't optional. It isn't optional. The idea that we can sort of stay the same and not learn new skills is not a possibility. We have to do that, and we have to build mechanisms to do that. And one common problem people have in this area is they sort of, review and development are two very distinct functions, review and evaluation versus learning, right? And we sometimes lump those together in our organization, like I'm gonna review your performance, Rebecca, and then we'll talk about what you can work on. That's not smart, actually. You need to separate those two functions, because to learn, we need to take risks, we need to fail, we need to sort of be free of evaluation besides our own. So you want to get your salary and your evaluation far from the learning process as you can. And I've seen some progressive organizations import sort of someone who's not in the hierarchy. They're simply sort of a learning and development officer, coach, if you will. And you go to them and you say, I want to learn to write better emails. I want to learn to run better meetings. And they'll help you do that. Or you go to them and say, I want to learn how to juggle. And they'll help you do that too. Yeah. So I see these organizations that are really focused on, we want to help you grow however you want to grow. Because in the end, you can't do development to people. People have to develop themselves. So you need to build an environment and an ecosystem in your company where they can do that, which means resources.
Yeah. It's an interesting food for thought. I think especially as we approach the end of the financial year, we're certainly all in the midst of our development reviews at the RSA at the moment.
It's kind of vulnerable review, don't you think?
So now I'm going to open up to the audience for your questions. If you could please keep them brief and also wait for the microphone. Yes, we'll start here.
Thank you. And Dan, thank you very much for a great talk today. I'd really like to pick up on the point that you were just talking about around proximity. I love what you've written about in the book about the Allen curve, this sense that relationships degrade once we go beyond 8 meters distant from someone else. Right. You spoke a little bit about the challenges within larger organizations, but I'm interested in your perspective on the challenges around dispersed organizations right. of whatever size. Right. So thinking about groups, thinking about teams coming together, working remotely, working through online collaboration and the like, yeah. How is it that we can really sort of establish all of these great processes really around sort of team development right. when we're working on a remote basis?
Right, right. Great question. A couple of overarching thoughts. First of all, face-to-face is far better for building any kind of relationship. If I give you a request in person and digitally, you are 34 times more likely to give me a yes if I make it in person. 34 times. So we're not talking about a small effect. 34 times. So overarching, try to be in the same room as much as you can. Other overarching thought is, it differs whether you're working creatively or whether you're simply trying to be productive, right? Simple productivity, dispersed teams work quite well. Really? There's no distraction. You can do your job. Creativity, they don't. Creativity, they don't. They won't bring up the problems. They won't wrestle with them. They won't have the casual interactions that matter the most. And so really deciding that, so the two sort of rules I would say is be together as much as you can and think about it in terms of what creative work do we really need to be better for and what productive work can we really do apart? You're welcome.
Got a question at the back there.
Hi. Thank you, Daniel. It's fantastic. Loved your last book as well.
Well, thank you.
Two questions, if I may. Firstly, the role of conflict and arguments, and, yep. And secondly, related perhaps superstar talent, real highly talented people
right.
in a group, and how that affects cohesiveness.
Great question, great question. Conflict and argument are the daily bread of these successful groups. They are able to have healthy exchanges of views, full and frank exchanges of views all the time, because they are sending those sorts of intense signals of connection. When you are connected, then you can have those arguments. That kind of argument is crucial. The best idea wins, right? The best idea wins in these places. And so they're constantly building that sort of foundation of connection so they can have that argument and so they can really embrace that argument. Your second question about sort of rock star talent, extreme talent. Well, most of the groups that I visited had a simple rule, which I will sum up in a non-profane way, as saying no jerks. No jerks. No matter how brilliant. No brilliant jerks, actually, is a good way to say it. No brilliant jerks. They were very intolerant, no matter how brilliant the talent, of someone who would come in and disrupt the group. And the science for that is fascinating. There's a bad apple study that I reference in the book where they bring in one person to be a bad apple in a four-person group, and the bad apple simply folds his arms a little bit and is apathetic, and productivity goes down 30 to 40% in that group instantly. We are acutely sensitive. It's because it's a safety signal, right? This group isn't going to work. Everybody checks out. So extreme intolerance of bad apples. That would be what I've seen, no matter how talented. The San Antonio Spurs sum this up. They are the most successful National Basketball Association franchise in the last 30 years. They have a scouting report that they put in all the players, and there's a box at the bottom that says, not a Spur. And no matter what it says on the top, if that bottom box is checked, they won't touch that player. That player could be the second coming of Kareem Abdul-Jabbar and Michael Jordan combined, and they would not draft him because he's not a Spur. That's how intolerant they are. And really, it's not intolerance, it's protection. They're putting their culture first. They're putting their relationships above all else.
Got two questions on this side towards the front. We'll take the third row first and then the first row.
Hi, thank you. I really understand kind of the importance of leadership, but I'm wondering, the people who are kind of members and participants of successful groups, right. do you find they can kind of replicate that in other groups, or is right. it just all down to kind of the specific different cultures and leadership?
The leader has a high leverage position, and this is just the way human beings are built. The shadow of leadership is very large, but there are many examples of places where culture sort of started at the middle and grew up, where there's real power in the middle. A lot of it has to do with the fact that our culture is really the 15 feet around us, the 20 feet around us. But there's a new, have you guys heard about sociometrics? Sociometrics. It is a science where they take little cards and hang them around your neck in an Orwellian way. And then it captures the energy in your voice. It captures whether we're face to face or if I'm 2 degrees away from you. It captures who talks to who. And you end up with kind of a satellite view fingerprint of an organization's interaction. It's kind of stunning to see. And what that data shows is that making small changes in everyday life, especially like around the lunch table, if you go from a 4-top to a 12-top at work, it increases idea flow and connection and conversation. It's a simple thing that you can do in life, but it makes a huge impact because you're just creating more collisions, more ideas. And informally, what I saw in a lot of places were a lot of it was around eating and drinking, you know, because that's what we do every day. That happens every day in every group. And there were always these sort of informal groups that were very strong culture in themselves in the middle, where it was all about that cappuccino group or that have a pint group, whatever that was. And that's where that culture lived and breathed.
One thing we've actually done around that here at the RSA is RCTs, or randomized coffee trials,
Ooh.
When any member of the organization
yeah.
can sign up and will get randomly matched with another
cool.
person on a weekly basis.
Dynamite. Were we matched that way? Is that how we met?
Let's take the question from the front row.
Hi, Daniel. In your research, did you reach any sort of insights or opinions about whether the typical principles of target setting and individual bonuses helped or hindered a culture?
I'm from Alaska. I answer most questions with those three words. I did not dig in. I'm not from the business. I didn't take kind of a business point of view to looking at this question. I know that what I did see was the kind of, they would set up systems where they would give bonuses to each other. If you and I had a great conversation and we both worked at Zappos, I could give you $200 just for being a good guy. And I have a budget to do that, which is interesting. It's sort of taking that bonus idea and giving it to the people rather than having it descend from the papal seat. It actually is in control. And a lot of organizations do that, and I find that fascinating. Right? Now, but I don't really have any deep data. I am from Alaska, sadly.
There are a couple of questions on this side of the room. We'll take one from the front row and then the third row.
I'm interested in groups for students, particularly students now very much focus on their group projects. Have you looked at this, groups for students and even groups for teachers and that whole area?
Yeah, right. Beyond marshmallow towers, you mean. Yeah. No, that's an interesting one. I mean, I think we see in schools kind of an unparalleled opportunity to create culture. You know, we walk into a good school and you can feel that culture. And some of the most intense early reads of this book have been from teachers who really see the ability to bring this into their classroom, that there is a physics underneath relationships. So I don't have a deep answer to that question except to say that what a perfect sort of petri dish to grow a community where you are together every day, you're involved in a big story together, you're constantly connecting and constantly being vulnerable. And we see that sort of school model. It's almost like businesses are becoming more like schools. In fact, that's what at the Cleveland Indians, where I advise, we talk about ourselves as a baseball school. That's the metaphor we use. We have 7 campuses, different minor league teams, and we have 1 graduate school, the major leagues. And that's how we approach life. And it actually has been incredibly, that has kind of unlocked a way of interacting for us. So I don't know that this has affected schools as much as schools have kind of affected this in other worlds.
The whole point of group projects is to get them ready for the workplace.
That's right.
Yeah,
right, exactly.
Work and learn from the school.
That's right, that's right. So it sort of reaffirms the model, I guess. Mm-hmm. Yeah, thank you.
Great question.
Did you find that the highly successful groups tended towards being diverse, or did they all kind of homogenize a bit, the really successful ones?
Hungry for diversity. The San Antonio Spurs are the first team in the NBA to hire a woman assistant coach. Hungry for diversity, but still battling bias. We tend to hire people like ourselves. And one of the kind of things that emerged from this, which I will shamelessly steal from Adam Grant, who if you haven't read, you should, brilliant writer on a lot of this stuff, is we tend to hire for fit. We hear that a lot, hire for cultural fit. Don't hire for fit, hire for contribution. If we hire for fit, we'll end up with a lot of people that look just like us. And if we hire for contribution, we'll end up with a diversity of voices and a diversity of ideas, which is really what drives innovation. All the science around diversity says the more diverse that room is, the better your ideas are. So it's not just about being sort of moral, it's about being smart.
Question from the back and another one on that side. We've got a few hands up, so I'm going to group the questions now. We'll take this one, another one at the back, and middle section.
Hey, you've talked a lot about when things are going right. Have you got any examples of where culture, inverted commas, has gone wrong, and how companies, organizations, what the first few steps might be to fix things?
Yeah, right, right. Now, vivid example. It's funny. I spent a few years of my life in the cycling world, doping, and talk about a culture that's got things wrong. I mean, we've seen vividly in the last couple of days just how that can tip people into behavior that they couldn't have dreamed of. And it's fascinating how powerful it is. And I think the best sort of mental model for it is that it functions just the same way. There's a sense of connection and belonging, and they're sharing vulnerability and they're sharing weakness, and there's a story there. There's a story there. And I think the piece that matters the most is the story. The story of cycling, for instance, is everyone's cheating. That's the story. That's the story that drove that behavior. People who cheat do not do it to cheat to gain an edge. They actually do it to make it fair. That's why you see indignation in Wiggins' voice. That's why you see indignation in Armstrong's voice. All the people who get caught are angry because they feel like they were right. They were just leveling the playing field. So when the story of the sport is broken, as I think it is in some of our sports, you have this bad behavior. I would say that they're not necessarily bad people in a different environment. They might behave very differently. And I can say with assurance that if you were a pro cyclist in the early 2000s, You could have said no for a while. You could have said no for maybe even a year, but most of us would ultimately have joined because we're social animals, and that's what we do. You know, very few people would have taken the high road and say, everyone else can cheat, but I won't. It's really hard to do. It's really, really hard to do. So that story piece of culture ends up being massively important.
We'll take three questions now. So one from the back, and then the middle section, and middle over here.
Yeah, I was very struck by the obvious but nonetheless important sort of reminder around vulnerability being the way to build trust. And as somebody who works and has managed and led a lot of teams in the non-profit sector, one of the challenges that I come up against a lot is this idea of the identified person in a group on whom people sort of put all the bad stuff. So, you know, the group ceases to function because it's one person's responsibility, which of course is not the case at all, but it often becomes a barrier to build trust amongst the group. And I just wonder if it's a sort of scenario that you're familiar with and what tips you might have to try and sort of break that down.
How fascinating. So
we're going to group a couple of questions now because we're running out of time. Right. So hold that thought for one moment. We'll take this one as well.
So I'm
going
to have to remember
them? Yes. Good. I might give you some brief reminders as well.
Don't group the questions, Rebecca. Don't group the questions. It really destroys the whole ambience of this. Steven Pinker said it last week. He said, do not group questions.
I trust him. I trust him. I'm with Stephen.
Okay.
I'm not grouping. I can't even remember what I said a minute ago.
We'll do away with the grouping in that case.
What a cool question. I think that does. That happens when it's a question about narrative. It's a question about story. What is your story? And our story naturally centers on people. What is Apple? It's Steve Jobs, right? That's what Apple is. What is Manchester United? I don't know Manchester. Ferguson, maybe? Would that be right? Not anymore. Used to be Ferguson, right? So, but being intentional about the story that you tell about your community, about your group, so that it doesn't naturally get centered. There's a sort of almost a natural bias, weight of gravity that'll get focused on a human face. But you're in control a little bit over what that story gets told. So finding ways, unearthing stories that you can share that aren't centered on one individual, that are centered on the people you benefit. I saw a cool example of this. Do you know the company Square? They were searching for a way to tell their story. They found a Syrian refugee who had moved to Tennessee in America and who had opened a falafel stand and was sort of saving and rescuing his family by using Square. And, you know, there are many ways to tell the story of Square with data, but that story brings people to tears. When you see, they sent a documentary team out to catch his story, to capture that story of him and his family swiping on Square and the power of that. And so being intentional about unearthing those stories as opposed to letting whatever default story land on someone's face that you might end up with would be what I would say in my ungrouped response.
Thank you.
So my company has given us and my team the opportunity to self-organize. And one of the hesitations or concerns that we have as a group is the tension that will create between our group and the rest of the organization. And so I was curious about what sits at that edge of the group with the strong culture and perhaps a part of the organization or a part of the community that doesn't.
Yeah, I've seen that tension some places too. It can be difficult when there's sort of a group of cool kids, or whatever you want to call them, that are doing their own thing different than the rest of the organization. I would say building bridges would be my two-word response. Building bridges between those places and make sure there's healthy communication and conversation across that divide. But self-organizing is tough. That's quite a task they've given you. And I've seen groups do it successfully. There's a wonderful orchestra, I think they're called Orpheus, that is completely self-organized. There's no hierarchy. It's also really painful to watch them practice because coming to consensus on a piece of art is really difficult, and so you see the advantages of hierarchy. Hierarchy is the skeleton in the system that lets the muscles work, and so as you self-organize, I would say keep hierarchy in mind as a potential positive.
Question over here.
Go back to the marshmallow study with the kids and the adults. So what age have you addressed that the kids start to become the adults, and why? What are the underlying causes to why we're losing that cohesive group culture?
Now, do you do research here? That would be a fascinating topic for a design study. I don't know. It's always been kindergartners in the study. They've never looked up. They're definitely at that unconscious marshmallow eating age. I would that would be really interesting to look into. At what point do you sort of feel the status anxiety?
Yeah. I think actually one of the RSA's most popular animates on our YouTube channel is by the educationalist Ken Robinson, looking at divergent thinking in children and the trajectory of that. So maybe give that a watch.
What a great question. Thank you.
Question in the front here.
I had a follow-up on how do you spot positive culture in companies. I speak quite a lot to often senior management teams, and everyone has this shiny values paper. Often right. They have a motto and a purpose. And you mentioned purpose and psychological safety, a lot of work being done with that. But are there any sort of questions you can ask at that top level which really kind of give you a sense that this is a positive culture? They have got psychological safety there. Or is it really impossible until you meet the teams and be with them?
I think it's very difficult. I mean, all the research around interviews show that interviews are a terrible way to really assess how a relationship's going to go. It doesn't work very well. So I would encourage you to sort of think like a journalist, which means you operate from the outside in and you gradually move toward the center. Before you have the interview with the top, have loads of interviews around them so that you can actually bring as much to that last conversation as you can. In a journalist, you always interview the most important person last. And I would encourage you to do that in this case. Observe, absorb, and then go ask and see what you get. But I wouldn't trust it very much.
I think we've got time for one more question from the back row there.
It's just a very quick one. Could you tell us anything about the dynamic of introversion and extroversion in groups?
Yeah, that's a great question because we deal with it in our lives all the time. I found the one effective way, most cultures do, you know, there's a bit of an extrovert bias in some cultures because there's so much sharing and vulnerability going on in these places that introverts can have a hard time in certain ones. And one answer that I've seen that I liked was sort of the cave and commons model, which is in a world where we have so many open floor plans, we make space for a few caves. So when you need to be in a cave, you go in the cave. And when you need to be in the commons to share and have feedback and do AARs, you go in the commons. But to be able to toggle and to give people the freedom to toggle between those two is a valuable and an important tool for any culture.
Okay, well, sadly, I think that's all we've got time for. I'm going to slip in one final question from me.
Yes.
So you've written the talent code
yep.
and the culture code. What is next on the horizon for you?
It's a big book about my dog. I'm going to tell there's so many facts in it. It's filled with fascinating facts. More seriously, I'm kind of interested in the power of story. Story is the most potent drug, I think, ever invented, and I'd be curious to explore that.
Okay. Well, I can certainly say that the range of stories combined with that evidence that you present in the book are extremely powerful. And I think the thoughts that you've shared in this session have given me a lot of practical wisdom that I'm going to try and apply in the groups that I'm a part of. And I'm sure that you've had the same impact on many others listening today. So thank you both to our audience in the room and online as well for such a fantastic conversation. And just a reminder as well that Daniel will be signing copies of the Culture Code outside in the foyer after this. But before you dash off to do this, could you please give one final big hand to our brilliant speaker, Daniel Torres?
Thanks for listening. If you like this podcast, head to our YouTube channel for inspiring talks, interviews, and animations.